So this is a lunch talk, huh? So you are not going to see very many equations, but if you want to, I can hide that. This is the Microsoft PowerPoint, so you can hide slides. So I hit the slides that would be difficult for digestion. So let me tell you a couple of words of PCD in general, not because you don't know it, this would be embarrassing, but because I spent quite some time making this animation here. So you got to see this one. This is, of course, the string tension of Dilthey's separated quark. Of course, the other very interesting property of QCD is its thermal transition. And all of a sudden, at about 150 MeV, you go from essentially three degrees of freedom to more than 50. And Mike helped me count them correctly. My daughter saw that and said, this is not a quark gluon plasma. This is a quark gluon party. And it still has the initials PGP. So it's this dramatic effect that has lured us into this. And of course, there is the finite density transition. And unfortunately, I cannot tell you much about this. Not because there isn't a lot of work going on, but because it has an interesting sign problem, which is one of like outstanding problems in our field. So, but it is there, and it is extremely interesting. I put this slide on. If you haven't read this, it makes for a very nice bedtime reading. And Frank has been very helpful to our field. And you know, for me, going around IBM and I say the word QCD, people get jumpy and jittery, and they don't want to hear. And then, you know, even at conferences and things, people just hear QCD and they go, oh, you know, this is whatever. You're not a high-end. So I generally feel bad about doing QCD. So this was a very nice paper that makes me feel good about it. And it actually, of course, it is very... This is a thermal relationship. The points he makes here, of course, you all know them, but it's nice to see them again. Because QCD, it really is one of the most beautiful theories that we have. It is a relativistic quantum field theory with renormalizability and asymptotic freedom. These are not easy properties to have. It provides algorithms to answer questions. And Frank actually mentions lattice gauge theory. He believes in it. It is really a remarkable thing that you can calculate in this complicated theory. Its scope is wide. It covers probably all of the interesting things in physics. Not to mention that, 95% of the known matter in the universe is nuclear. It contains a wealth of phenomena. If you think about confinement, spontaneous symmetry breaking, anomalous instantons. And it has very few parameters. I mean, this is really remarkable. It's probably the most remarkable thing about it is, if you do QCD light, as he calls it, you just make two massless quarks only. There are really no parameters. The theory stands on its own. There's just these two integers, three colors and two flavors. You plug them in and you have a world. It's alone. It's self-contained. And in this way, it may be somewhere else beyond the PV scale. Of course, you all know about this. But it is really a self-contained, beautiful thing that stands on its own. And of course, it's been verified experimentally. It's not just fantasy. And he likes to drill in this point, I suppose. QED is not a beautiful theory because it's not asymptotically free, and you know the rest of it. So QCD is really one of our prized possessions. These slides will put some of you to sleep, and so I will not go through them in detail because you already know about all this. The point is, the theory is beautiful, but how do you calculate? And granted, at a very weak coupling, you can do weak coupling perturbation expansions. At very strong coupling, you can do 1/g expansions. And these are actually beautiful and members here have done them, the first to do them, and that's how confinement really demonstrated in a very elegant way. The problem is the intermediate regime, where the conflict is not very strong or not very weak, and what do you do there? And you can sum your theories in various ways, your series in various ways, but at the end of the day, in a lot of cases, you are left with a lattice. And the lattice is indispensable in these cases. You all know how you put a Gauge theory on the lattice. You put the Gauge fields on the links and the Fermion fields on the sides. And the axiom looks very simple. It was written down in 74. It hasn't changed much. The limits that this theory has to, when you calculate, you of course don't, you do not do the exact thing. You have a computer, you're doing a Gauge theory with fermions, you have to do a lot of approximations, one of them of course being that it is a lattice. So the Lorentz symmetry is recovered as the lattice spacing goes to zero. The Gauge symmetry is exact, and that's really the beauty of this. There are flavor symmetries that are global. Some are exact, some are recovered very slowly as the lattice spacing goes to zero. And this really is the big problem. And the other big problem is that this 2 to the 10 is 1,000. So if you have a lattice and you decide that you want to double the number of points in one direction by a factor of 2, the price you have to pay in computing is 2 to the 10. It's not 2 to the 4th.
This is by far too pessimistic. Just not true, but okay, you can see.
Really? You don't think so?
It's not true in general, yes? Maybe it is true for some
other. I mean, dynamical QCD.
Yes, of course.
We can count the factors. It's somewhere in here. I thought 2 to the 8th is on. We can discuss it. I would appreciate your input. That's my experience with. Go ahead.
Is this for domain of fermions?
No. This is no. This is not for domain.
How would it be for domain of fermions?
The dependence would be the same. The thing that would be different is that once you pay this factor.
Why? Because you have factor dimensions. So I would.
This is the space-time dimension that I decreased, let's say, by a factor of 2. And then you have to pay 2 to the 4. Suppose the fifth dimension, you keep it fixed. So that's why.
I suppose that, because you want to be more accurate, so you increase that by an equal amount.
Yeah. No. Let me come to this. That is really at the bottom of the domain of fermions. That is the argument of why you want to do that. The point is that the chiral symmetry is recovered linearly with the size of sites along the extra dimension, and not with this factor. So you can fix your lattice spacing at a given size, and then if you want to get better chiral symmetry, you don't have to make it smaller. You can just go increase that linear fifth direction and pay a linear price instead of this horrific price. That is the point of that. There is, of course, now in the 2 to the 8, I don't know if I can count them on top of my head. There's the obvious 2 to the 4th, and then there is, because the volume is increased, because the Hamiltonian and the Lagrangian has gone up now by a factor 2 to the 4th, the delta t step in the Hyper-Monte Carlo evolution has to go up by 2 to the 4th. So that's the 2 to the 8th.
What I want to say is that this depends on the action you are using, surprisingly, and also it depends very much on the outer. And so I think this 10 to the 10 is definitely a much, much overestimate. Yeah. I would say 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6.
Oh, you mean 10 or 2?
Sorry, 2 to the 6. 2 to the 5 to 2 to the 6, yes. Which is if you have a good action in the middle.
But it means that you only have a factor 100 for the light, dealing with the light fermions. In addition to the space-time factor?
Well, this
is presumably not the topics of your show.
Yes, it's not, but I would like to discuss so with this. Please take this very seriously.
You would even be better than for a lot of Zonic. You were as good as for the best of Zonic.
I have
strong doubts.
Maybe that's why we are here for the other sciences. I know that this number is everywhere in the literature and maybe everywhere in the heads, but perhaps it is not the truth.
Well,
it's not a question of.
No, I mean, yeah. So these two. I would be surprised if you get something.
Why don't you simplify these things? That's something that is much worse than 2 to the 4. I think everybody will agree on that.
2 to the 6 is not very much worse than 2 to the 6.
2 to the 6, everybody.
Now, what I would say, to add to the protoprophecy, I would say linear algebra goes to the volume two, and you have the volume three, then it's 2 to the power 12.
Relation lines. I mean,
you don't need
slow.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I couldn't hear that. You said that the volume.
Your algebra goes as the volume square, and you have the lattice, so you have at least 2 to the power 12.
So you know.
I average the two. I am the. Let me go on, but please do take these comments very seriously because I should qualify this, and you're right to correct me. This is for a traditional Hybrid Monte Carlo evolution algorithm with traditional unimproved actions. So, and with traditional way of dealing with a low laying eigenvalues of the Dirac operator. Because the other factors from 2 to the 8 to 2 to the 10 have to do with critical slowing down on the inversion because of the small eigenvalues, which can be treated probably better. And also have to do with statistics, because now you have to run longer runs. But again, please take this seriously, and I will qualify. So with this qualification, you'll agree that that's the number. You say I can do a lot better than that, right?
2 to the 6 is still not a very small number. So.
Well,
it's smaller than 2 to the 10.
See, it's funny how these numbers translate. If we attach a dollar sign in front of it for somebody that is buying a computer, they would think it's a big number. Right, but it's so it's not a, it is a big number.
He has to convince IBM that the community needs these big machines.
Hey, come on now, that's a good gig, right? So the fly in the ointment of all this has been from day one the doubling problem. And I'm sure many of you have struggled with this, but just indulge me because this was one of the things that lured me into this field. In the continuum, so I'll describe the non-transform. In the continuum, the Marshall's Dirac operator is this function acting on a plane wave, and you look at the number of zeros, and this is the number of particles. So d dx acting on e to the I dx brings down to p, and you have 1, 0 at p equals 0. Now, take this ridiculously simple operator and put it on the lattice. It's just a finite difference. Now, apply it on a plane wave, and you get e to the IPX, e to the, which is the x anyway, plus 1 and minus 1, so you get a sine of p here. Because you get e to the IP to the minus IP from this and this. This guy here has 2 zeros, one at 0 and one at pi over 2. So you started with 1. In the continuum, it should be one particle. In the lattice, just a discretization makes it 2. And you say, well, this is just some silly way. You must be able to fix that. But no, it has been years and years and years until the 90s, with the efforts of many of you here, that this problem was finally put under control. Because before then, the only way to treat this problem was at the expense of the Karas. So here's a list of the ways to put fermions on the lattice. And I'm probably forgetting something, but maybe I'm catching the bulk of it. There are at least 9 ways that we know how to do this. And the point is, of course, that this year, from 3 to 9, are very closely related cousins. The first two are quite different. So why I show you this is because these different ways of looking at the same thing, in this particular case, have revealed things that you wouldn't have known if you have just stayed with one way. If you have only stayed with the mangled fermions and you never want to overlap, you would have never known the deep connections to the index theorem. So that's just an example of why you need many ways. And this is one of my favorite quotes from Feynman, because then for psychology you must keep all the theories in our heads, and every theoretical physicist who is any good knows 6 or 7 different theoretical representations for exactly the same physics. So this speech is like, do you know your 6 or 7 ways? You know that they are all equivalent.
It's 2 to the 6.
So you know that you cannot distinguish them at the level where you're considering them, but there are ways to figure new things. So I don't know how late I'm running. Ready? The main role fermions.
Minutes
to go a little faster, but again, this is fairly simple. This is an old idea, it's very old, but somehow we Lattice people got a whiff of it when Kaplan did this. And if you have a defect mass, if you have the standard Dirac operator in 5 dimensions, so you have a gamma 5 d5, and you put a mass term which has a defect, change the sign at some point. It doesn't have to be a step function. It can be anything that changes the sign. Then, if you insist that your 4-dimensional theory is masses, therefore this acting on the psi field is zero, then you're left with this part acting on the psi field being, you make this requirement. Solving this equation is trivial, and you get this answer. It's an exponential decay. For the plus chirality modes, you get the minus, and with the minus for the minus chirality modes, you get a plus. And what's amazing about it now is that, of course, the plus chirality modes decay exponentially, the minus chirality modes blow up exponentially, therefore they're not normalizable, they're not there. So you start with a vector theory in 5 dimensions, massive vector theory in 5 dimensions, and you end up with a 4-dimensional massive chiral theory. Now this is really, really beautiful, and it really is just these 2 transparencies. And it runs deep, the solutions are localized on this effect, so this is it's known how fermions localize it, that's not new, but it shows up here in this way, and you can use it on the lattice. The big question at the time was how the 5-dimensional gauge fields will come into the play, and a lot of work went into this. I personally feel that there's still something here left, but it's pretty clear that for QCD, the 4-dimensional gauge fields should be the same, and that was result of work by Herbert and Narayanan, and Kaplan suggested that they should be fixed. So you view this 5th direction as an internal flavor space with fixed gauge fields alone. And this is an introduction to the overlap. Again, if this is a 5th direction, and you have a mass that changes sign somewhere in the middle, so there's a transfer matrix with a mass of negative sign for some steps, and a transfer matrix with a mass of a positive sign for some steps. So this Hamiltonian, so this T is e to the minus h some Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian for T plus projects out the state 0 plus, and the other one projects out the state 0 minus. You can look at those and realize they're bulk, so you divide them out, and you end up with this expression for one single chiral fermion. Now, this phase here is it's bothersome, and you have to deal with it, but for anomaly-free theories, the gauge dependence is very, very weak, and a lot of work has gone into this. People are very convinced now that this is not a problem. For a vector theory, you don't even have to worry about it, because you do, to make a Dirac spinner, you need 2 chiral fermions. So if you put them together, of course, this goes away, and you have this beautiful expression for the overlap, which now you can. It has a nice interpretation that it actually has an index. It is a definition of an integer index on the lattice. This is highly non-trivial. This means that if the filling levels of these 2 states are different, this is going to be 0. And the number of creation or annihilation operators you have to insert in here in order for this not to be 0 is actually the index. So the number of negative n values of h plus and minus. This differentiates the index. When a configuration changes from one topological sector to another, h plus develops a 0 eigenvalue, and in that case, t plus has a unit eigenvalue because it can be h plus is t plus. And in that case, the walls do not decouple. You have the same transfer matrix across, which is 1. So when the topology changes, just the moment it changes, it is where you have the worst problems in domain of Fermi. And in the lattice, you all know there is no topology. Instantons can disappear in the cracks, right? If they shrink below the lattice size, they disappear. So this is a topology changing phenomenon, which is a lattice artifact. And that lattice artifact makes this problem very bad. So a problem in the gauge sector presents itself as a problem in the fermion sector of the theory. And this is just now how you do domain of Fermi today. This is the step here is infinitely high. Before I had it as like this for the mass. So this is one chirality, this is the other chirality. They are localized on the walls here. That's why they're called domain wall fermions. But here they have a small overlap. The longest this direction is, the smaller the overlap. And that's why I said that the chiral symmetry is restored linearly with a lens. This as you make it bigger, you get smaller overlap here. This is free field theory, and it tells you that the residual mass, which is due to this overlap here, is 1 minus m naught raised to the mn. So the point here is that you can fix your lattice spacing at any value you like. So the point is you decouple restoration of Lorentz symmetry from restoration of chiral symmetry. That's the point. The point is Lorentz symmetry is, even if it's not fully recovered for QCD, for supersymmetric theories, of course, would be different. But at least for QCD, Lorentz symmetry hasn't given us much problems. So you can pick a fairly large coupling. But then chiral symmetry would be a problem for staggered or Wilson fermions. But for domain Hall fermions, it's a problem which you can do away with by increasing LS. So the two limits are decoupled, and computing is only linear in LS. So you don't have to pay these large factors. It's not that you gain something for nothing. It's that you don't improve something you don't need to improve at an extra cost. You just improve the fact that part that you would like to improve. Here's a demonstration of how well the overlap index is agreeing with the topological charge. And this is the topological charge in an ensemble of configurations of SG2, and this is their frequency. And you see the squares are the topological charge, and the diamonds are for the index theorem, the index. So this is one is Gates quantity, this is a fermionic quantity. And they agree very nicely, even on the lattice, and this is a fairly strong coupling, and the Q squares you see are fairly close. So the way you count the index again, this is the Hamiltonian that I told you would change. You count how many positive eigenvalues it has and subtract how many negative eigenvalues it has. So you're going to count how many of these are here, how many of these are here, you take the difference, and that's the index. It starts with the same eigenvalues plus and minus. There is a crossing here, but there are two crossings, so this is no change. And there is a single crossing here going up, so all of a sudden there is a change. And that is the index. One half of that is the index.
How do you define the topological charge complex?
Well, in this data, I took it from another paper, and I believe it was Lucier's definition.
You mean the geometrical
one? The geometrical one.
So it should be a...
It's not a... the geometrical one, you know, it's been a while, so I...
No, Q is an index.
Q is not... The topological charge, I have to look... Tell you the reference, I forget now. But here you won't get, these are integers values that I don't remember. It has to be, yeah, I believe it's the integer one.
Okay.
If it's
topological, it's obviously, but it's still. I'll give you the reference after the talk. This one. I'm sorry?
M naught is a parameter which you.
M naught. This is actually an excellent question, because M naught now is an extra parameter. Not only you got LS, the size of the extra dimension, you got M naught too. And they should have nothing to do with physics, right? They're not parameters of QCD. So what are they? The point is that once you set your M0, let's say, here, it turns out that the exponential decay away from the walls is governed by a coefficient which is this difference. So you can put it here and it will decay with this coefficient. You can put it here and it will decay a little slower. So you have a range of M0 you can pick. It's not a fixed number. So you can pick between here and here. It typically gets renormalized, but it's a range. So once you pick it somewhere in that range, it becomes also not a parameter anymore. Now, LS is just effectively controls how good your calculation is, how well you want your calculation to treat chiral symmetry. And so once you fix M0, you have picked up your decay coefficient, and then chiral symmetry is restored as e to the minus the decay coefficient times LS. So the choice, I'm sorry.
I wondered, why is there a crossing of the second and third lowest eigenvalue?
This here?
No, downstairs.
Here?
No, up, a little bit up. To the left, a little bit higher.
Here you mean somewhere?
No, lower.
Here.
At 0.95, here.
Lower.
Sorry.
Oh, here, I see. Yeah, I cannot, presumably, well, if I plot, I only show you a snapshot of the M0 range. This really goes from 0 to 9. So this picture kind of repeats itself for the doubler species. So this one presumably is already heading up and it's going to cross somewhere at 2.7. Every 2 is another brilliant zone. So that's, it is going up, and if you had done it, it probably would have crossed in the next brilliant zone. So it's not as simple as I presented.
This is the, in the negative mass, M0 is the negative mass.
M0 is the fifth dimensional mass.
Negative mass.
And if you did Wilson fermions, this spectrum here is gamma 5 dW. It's gamma 5 times the Wilson operator. This eigenvalue. It turns out that this is e to the minus gamma 5 dW is the transfer matrix for domain fermions. So one other way to look at this, if you were doing Wilson fermions, you would try to fine-tune M0 somewhere over here to cancel out this eigenvalue. And that is the fine-tuning problem of Wilson fermions. You have to exactly cancel out that eigenvalue. But this is for one configuration. There will be another one will be here. So that's why Wilson fermions have this problem at strong coupling. This thing moves back and forth, so you cannot really exactly cancel it and therefore recover chiral symmetry. Here in the Mengel fermions, this problem has been transformed from one of fine-tuning to one of an exponential decay in the supercritical region, which are Wilson fermions would have been here. This is minus M Wilson.
Right.
That's what you're asking.
So if the negative one, there is a fingers, four fingers,
correct,
which shows up. So it somehow you magically choose, it goes into the first finger. Right?
Correct. Yes.
It's not magic.
You just pick it. You have to pick the right range, but it's a range. It's not fine-tuning.
Right. Then the question is, how do you know if it's inside that finger, not going to the Aoki phase? So how do you know those phenomena? That's the real question here.
Correct. So the way you know.
Right. The two things. There's Aoki, there are fingers.
Not the same thing.
Right. So the fact that you don't, there are these five bubbles that you can be in, and right, you're in the first bubble.
Four bubbles.
Over.
Right.
That's separate issue. So if you're in the first bubble, that's it.
I guess he's wondering how.
Aoki is another story.
Aoki. It's a Wilson story. It's not a
Wilson case. It's Aoki phase. You can for the same M values, if you tune G square to certain values, it goes in the Aoki or not. So here, the G square he didn't provide me in that case, the, he only changing the mass, and basically, if t is finite, there is a chance that he can pass a of k and goes into the finger.
Correct. This is correct. He's asking what happens if this shrinks. If suppose this shrinks down, suppose there are a lot of crosses here. How do you know where to go?
My single point was that these bubbles that you have.
What
I want to is a g-square. A g-square equals 10 to the minus 100. There will be still bubbles. And we will have no problem to be anywhere, and the whole key will be nowhere to bother the US. That's all I was saying.
All that happens is the thickness of this cross.
The point I want to make is, these we can't. I am very spectrum cannot tell him by tuning him whether he's in AOK phase or not.
No, that's not correct. In principle, if we could work at a very large beta or a small G square, there would be no problem to tell that you're in
the right. That cleans up completely.
Actually, the eigenvalues can exactly tell you whether you're in AOK phase or not, because you're only in the AOK phase if there is a finite density of zero eigenvalues at the mass that you're working
at. There are many answers to your question. What works, and he did it with Robert and Edwards and Narayana, is you could look at the zero when there's a crossing.
If you want to get to
let me answer this, but there are some good answers.
Right, okay.
We can convince him later.
Okay, I'll convince you privately in a room with a closed door. So now this is something that I actually find very interesting. You put an instanton in the lattice and you use Steiger fermions and you measure an operator that has it singular, because if it has a zero mode, it has to blow up as you decrease the mass. And for Steiger fermion, you see, it's just kind of start turning here, but then it changes its mind and it goes down. This is an instanton, a smooth instanton. If you did domain wall at the less equal 4, this is the size of the fifth direction, again, it doesn't blow up. But you see, as you increase the less, it's beautiful. And in fact, it is robust. So if you put noise in that instanton, it still stays like that, because there is no fine tuning. And this is something that was amusing, because at Columbia at the time, when we first did these simulations with domain wall, everybody was skeptical. And we did Quentz first, and we measured psi bar psi. And people were used to seeing this thing and then extrapolate and find the bed and say, well, Karasimov is broken. So I remember I was gone for the couple of days that this simulation was done. I came back and they told me, this is nonsense. I was like, oh my God, yes, finally. And you see a zero mode. This is a zero mode in a real quantum simulation blowing up the psi bar psi. Of course, dynamical fermions will actually suppress the zero mode for this operator, for at least for two flavors. The point of this is to tell you that as the coupling becomes weaker, as the blood spacing becomes smaller, the decay coefficient becomes larger, and therefore you need less fifth direction to get chiral symmetry. So things get better as you approach the continuum limit. And this is really where things were left in about 2000. This is the decay rate. This is the residual mass, the decay rate versus LS. And if you want to be around here, you need an LS of about 80.
What is the decay rate?
M residual is what is left of chiral symmetry that is not due to you. It's due to the regulator. So as you increase LS, this has to go to zero. But it goes to zero with a very small slope, is the point. It will hit 0.01 somewhere over here. So right here, the pines are about 400 mm.
To my other question, saturate
is some point. This is a pipe square you're seeing here. It's for quench.
No,
it doesn't saturate.
It doesn't keep going until you increase it.
Well,
at some point.
No, that's not true. It does keep going. It would keep going. It has to keep going, but it goes with a very small decay coefficient. And that's the problem. But again, I'm running out of time, so maybe to take this This is the eye diagrams. This is what I showed you before for an incident, but now for a real quench simulation, you want to be somewhere here to be able to see a decay. One point here, that if you did dynamical QCD simulations, about 10% of the code consumes about 90% of the cycles. So this is really the part of the code you want to optimize. And finally, I'll show you something about the blue gene. I think there is something in a name, because that was a clever name, and I think it carried its way. The machine is a three-dimensional torus. That means that all the nodes are connected in a three-dimensional grid. So the data flows across wires connected in a three-dimensional grid. However, as I tell you in a minute, it is not really a three-dimensional torus. It's any to any. The machine is assembled this way. You start with a microchip, which you designed at IBM Watson, that has two processor units in it. You put two of these microchips in a card. So this card has four processor units, two here and two here, and memory in between. And then you assemble 32 of these chips in a 32-way card. You plug 32 of those in a rack, which is the size of a refrigerator. So this is 1,000 processors. Peak speed is 5.6 gigaflops. So this is 5.6 teraflops. And then you hook up these racks together, and the larger system will be 64 racks with a peak of 360 teraflops. Now, these are amazing numbers, 360 teraflops. This is the chip, and you see the two processors, PD0, PD1. This actually is the chip. And they have this, each processor has a double multiply add unit in it. So you can do two multiply adds. So this guy can do two multiply adds, and this guy can do two multiply adds. So you have four operations per cycle.
Quick question.
Go ahead.
Is this design different from QGDOC?
Yes. It's quite different, but also very similar in some ways. QCDOC has one core and does not have this double multiply add units in it. But it does have this embedded memory. This is a large memory which is very close to the processor, so that access is very fast. In our case, it's 4 megabytes. So it is big. It does fit the lattices that we are interested in. So you can put QCD in here. So the networks are different for QCDOC.
And
the main network, the three network, is very similar, the global
and
reduction network.
Another question is this available commercially right now?
Oh, yeah.
If I have money, can I buy? If you have money, you can buy.
Sure, I will open the door now. Let's go. I don't know. This is America, but somewhere I'm not allowed to buy him more than a cookie or something, like the express.
Oh, no. I just wonder,
yes,
whether
yes.
GF11 was not commercial.
No, but this is highly commercially available. It is already installed. There are 16 racks at Livermore right now. It's been sold to Holland. Sorry?
Do you know how much the refrigerator costs?
Yes, but if I told you, then that would kill me, or I'll have to kill you. So it is a variable price depending on how much you buy, it's a place where I'm not allowed to go.
I cannot get to the magic $1 per megaflop.
Hey, now come on. There are magic numbers, and again, they are not fixed numbers. But the way that they have arranged, IBM has arranged this, it's a large customer that will buy more than like four racks or something like that.
Yeah.
And then they make some special arrangements and stuff. It's a small customer that have put together a consortium at Argonne Lab, and you go and you give your dollars, and you are entitled to some fraction of the collective computing facility there, and that way you get a better price, because then you can buy bigger systems.
Argonne
Lab.
So that Argonne gets overhead.
Yeah, there's tons of applications running there right now.
Another quick question is, the software environments for this one, what kind of software does it use? For example, does it based on MPI or?
Yes, the software, obviously software, you can write your own and put it in here if we told you all the magic addresses. It runs MPI. The QCD numbers I will show you, it runs a layer that I wrote to directly interface with the hardware, because I was one of the people that designed it, and I know exactly what it does. But it does, most applications by far run MPI on this. There's a full-fledged operating system that, you know, it's IBM, and it will have all the rings, and bells and whistles. And then there are nodes that are specializing in I.O., and they run Linux on them. So,
oh, it's you, like Linux-based.
I'm sorry?
It's Linux-based.
No, no, the compute nodes, in order to do the actual calculation, have a very thin kernel that's custom-made at IBM. But in addition to the nodes that belong to the network, there are nodes that don't belong in that network that communicate via another another control network. And these nodes communicate with the PCs and with the loaders and with the disk, and these run Linux. Not a streamlined, the whole machine by far is not Linux. This is isolated few nodes to make access to the machine.
Consumer sees this inside, not at all, typically.
Exactly. The Linux will do the load of the of your program, for example. So you type, you know, load, blah, blah, and that means that it goes via Ethernet to the special node. Linux takes it, puts it down, and distributes it without another network on all the machines. Starts executing. If there is an interrupt, it passes it up. The data is fine, passes it up. But you can actually ping, you know, ping on these Linux nodes. So you can imagine there are a lot of people at IBM that do software. And it's the opposite, actually. It's too much. So I already told you about this. The point is that there's two multiplier units and two cores here. These are not coherent at the L1 level. These two caches are not coherent, but they are coherent below. There's 4 megabyte memory on the chip. The networks are accessed here, and for QCD are interested mostly in the Taurus network, which provides the nearest neighbor communication, and the global reduction network, which is used for global sums for the inverters.
And on your photograph before, L2 looked like one, L2 for both CPUs.
This one?
Yeah, L2 between TU1 and TU L2.
The L2 is really two L2s that have snoop in between them, so they are coherent. But they are very thin, and they are essentially a prefetcher. It's a prefetcher from L3 to L1, really. But they are. You see that line of the snoop here? They are connected. They are coherent at that point.
And do you have the bus rates? The rates of access?
They are here.
Oh.
And to get those, you have to do sequential accesses. And the interesting thing is that QCD is you just chunky accesses, you know, you chunk, and really stresses the memory system. So when we put QCD in this, they were surprised they were not getting what. And I think that was taught a lesson, I think, a valuable lesson, that if you don't do well in QCD, you have to do well in QCD to tell us. And I think people know this here from many years of experience with files for computers. QCD has to run well for any application. If QCD runs well, other applications that are grid-based will also run well. I think it's a lesson. So this is the two processors you see with the heat sinks on top.
Okay, so this QCD, what fraction of the peak rate do you get?
Yeah, I will show you the graph. So let me get there. So this is a 32 assembly. This is two racks at IBM Watson in June.
How many power do you have for one rack?
Watts.
So let's see. Let me try to remember this.
Power and cooling. Yeah.
It's about 10 watts. It's about 10 watts per chip.
Okay.
So it's 10 kilowatts for it's very low. Sorry. It's air cooled. It's not even water cooled, and so your electricity bill will be very low.
But the
way it works is that they have a raised floor. There's a floor that's raised about this much. It has air vents, and they have huge air conditioning around the walls that blow air from the bottom through the machine up to the top and circulate. So it is. Air cool means you don't have to worry some pipe breaking.
But the electrical bill includes not only running the machine, but running the air conditioning.
Okay, so double it. It has to be, right? It's conservation of energy somehow. So this is a computer generated picture of the machine and of the person.
The first law calculation.
I'm sorry?
That's a first law calculation. The second law calculation will make it worse.
Make it worse, that's right. Correct. It's a heat thing, right? It cannot be equal. The only reason I'm going to show you this is because it looks very, very similar to the eyes. I'm not sure there's a connection, probably there isn't, but
you see the
algae. You see the algae? In fact, because this is very high density packaging, so you cannot really, when you send the data across, you have to send the clock too. So when it arrives, you know what bit it was, if the bit was up, at which part of the clock it goes up, otherwise it makes no sense. But sending a clock wire across is expensive, you double the wires. So you don't send a clock across. So then how do you know when the transitions are? And no matter how this guy is clocking his data that he's sending me, he's clocking them. So he's only sending data during certain times. The transitions are during certain times. So I'm sitting here with an oscilloscope. I have to see this. So if I'm somewhere in the middle and sample my data points here, I get the correct data. And any noise, any crossings in here is considered noise, and it's not the correct thing. So there are too many similarities with the other thing. The network, it's quite sophisticated. It's very similar to the Cray T3. The way it works is the processor injects hardware packets with a hardware header that gives the destination into the network by writing into a certain memory address, a certain address. Then the hardware takes these packets and puts them into the network. Now, if the network, and then there are, let's say another packet arrives here, it's examined by the hardware whether it has arrived at its destination, and if it has, it's being put into this reception area where the processor puts it out. If it has not arrived, it queries, if it knows how busy these links are and how much space is available in the neighbors, and chooses a way out. So this is handled completely in hardware. There's no CPU interference. So in principle, any processor can send a message to any other processor. You have to incur the latency, but this is very small. There are virtual channels. This means that there's buffering. If there's no way to go out, you have to stay in the buffer temporarily. But if there is a way, you cut through. And there's some subtle issues that are very interesting, and this network being possible to deadlock them, like pattern can get gridlocked. And there's a solution to that, which is called an escape. It's an escape route. So you allow for a highway, a road that is open by the rules of the algorithm, so that it never deadlocks. So it's deadlock free. And this is another animation. You can choose to send your packets deterministically. That means first along one direction and then along another, or they can go however way they like, with depending on the congestion in the neighbor in the next step.
Are the links bidirectional, like
the RPC? Yeah, you have both. There have, you have 12 links. Because it's a torus, it has a circle. If it's not a torus, it cannot deadlock. But because it's a torus, you can find a situation. If you're in a circle, you can find a situation where you're waiting for a packet to do something, but that packet is blocked by somebody behind you.
But if it's bidirectional, we should talk about this later, actually.
Like, okay, sure. It's bidirectional and physically, it doesn't. It cannot backtrack, though. Maybe that's what confuses you. The rule is that if you're going to go from here to here, you pick the minimal route. You will not go, you will never go the other way. Unless you're told, there is a way to program the packet.
Shorter.
Sorry?
If it's shorter because it's preoccupied.
Correct. But if that is the part that is it's congested, you wouldn't choose the other way. And that's what is. Another property this network has is that across a straight line, you can send a packet with a certain bit set on the header that tells it, go deposit yourself there. So you can do global reductions across a line. This is the ping pong latency. So if I send the packet across and wait for it to come back, including software, including everything, MPC is linearly raising. It's exactly what you expect. And the all-to-all bandwidth, this is an important number because it's the number that we get if everybody sends to everybody. And this is the utilization of the link. So if the links are free while you're sending to everybody, everybody's sending to everybody, there's something wrong, obviously. So you want to be as high as you want, and about 1 kilobytes, you are more than about 90%, which is excellent. This is a list of applications that are running right now that have been ported. And you see down here in the left corner, TCP IBM. This is just snacking. This is a picture that I like because this is not a performance picture. This is an actual Hadron Monte Carlo evolution of the Carroll condensate for a real Wilson Hadron Monte Carlo Phi algorithm. And it was the first time that TCP sustained 1 teraflop. And I was sitting there watching the numbers come out. And, it was an experience because 1 teraflop sustain is almost something that we couldn't believe that could exist 10 years ago. But yeah, it's there and it's going to go away and we'll be able to do it in laptops maybe. The machines right now is 64,000 nodes at Livermore, but essentially this spring, about 30,000 nodes at IBM Watson in the spring. And at IBM Watson, it's basically life sciences that are using this machine. Maybe they will do something else, but they are all over it. I doubt it will be hard to pry them away from it. I will skip this. This is the performance that you are asking. The numbers, this is local lattice. So this is the lattice size for QCD on each one of these cores. So remember, each chip has two processors.
So this is on two processors?
On one processor.
On one processor.
I put the fourth dimension across the two processors, so they communicate via common memory. So the fourth dimension is local on the chip between the two CPUs. But so this is per CPU. So if you see that you increase here, it gets a little better. The best is 19%. This is percentages. These are percentages. If you go higher, you run out of L3. You run out of the memory that is local on the chip. So you have to go to external memory, and you have to do that carefully, and if you don't do it carefully, your performance just drops. But this local size, I think, is already worth it. People won't exceed that, because otherwise you have to wait forever to get your answer. So I think this is already pretty good. And this is a plot that, for us, is trivial. QCD is a nearest neighbor application. You increase the number of CPUs, nothing changes. It's nearest neighbor, right? It's flat. It's beautiful. But that's not the case for other applications. So now even people that didn't want to hear QCD saw these plots in their talks because it just looks so nice. Of course, we expect it. It's nearest neighbor. The
well,
soft...
That's getting too fast. So you say I'm that sorry. Practically between one node, probably not zero, but one CPU and 1,000 CPU, there is practically no change of the percentage.
There is a little bit, as you can tell, right? The little bit is because when I did that, I didn't have the global network, global sum working. So the global sum is done on the torus network. And if the number of nodes is small, it doesn't cost you much. But as they increase, then it becomes more expensive and it starts showing. So that's why you see a little thing. Otherwise, there's nothing else in the communication. It's just nearest neighbor and eventually a global sum. Nearest neighbor and a global sum via the tree.
I have a quick and personal question.
Personal?
I know the Colombia QCD, as QCD OSHI people, they have converted their QCD SP version into the QCD OSHI version.
For the physics software,
maybe?
Yes.
Maybe part of that, I think you have been involved before. But the same software, can it run on this blue line?
Yeah, that software was written overnight almost at Columbia, and I had a large part of it. And it's now it's called the Columbia Physics System, and people have added a lot of new algorithms in it and stuff like that. So what you see here is exactly that software. With the only change, so the acknowledgement here is actually true. Norman and Chris and Bob Mahini were very generous to allow me to take it because it is public domain now, but you know, it still is a property of Brookhaven and Columbia. But the additions I made to this were just in the kernel, in the Dirac operator kernel. I had to write it by hand in assembly for it to perform at this level. Otherwise, it wouldn't.
Right. However, I'm trying to understand that some details. The QCD OCD, there was a SciDec program, and through the SciDec program, they sort of make the whole code work and all over the framework. That was part of the project. And in that framework, does the BlueJean and BlueLight is included?
No, so no. This has nothing to do with that at all.
SciDec,
nothing of the SciDec, no, nothing at all.
And so you just personally batched over this library?
I took the software and I just changed the few pieces of it that had, were specific to the hardware. And exactly. So if you want to run under the CPS environment,
right, exactly.
It would be exactly the same. No, you can just take your code, put it there, and it
will work.
And the way I did it, and I have to do more work what I can, is I put everything that had to do with BlueGNL is isolated, and somehow you have to package it and go through the lawyers to be able for somebody to give it to somebody, because IBM has open source problems with Linux and I don't know what. So
basically, CPS is working on
this. This is CPS.
Basically, what you are running is CPS.
You have an algorithm that runs in CPS, it will run.
Oh, thank you. Then I should get some
money.
Should get money.
Get some money first.
So that is almost 20% of what was it?
About 90%.
Achieved by SMP. So you were SMP coding.
SMP?
Assembly.
Assembly. Yes. So it has to be very carefully done. Yes.
So is it, let's say, what kind of assembly is it?
It's an inline assembly.
This is the inline assembly.
It's inline assembly. It's fairly straightforward. I didn't have to read any manuals to do it. But you have to do it carefully. You have to know how the hardware behaves, how the memory behaves, to stage it. And there is no DMA. Anything that you do communication-wise cannot be overlapped with computation. So it takes it off the top. That's why in this performance plot here, performance figure here, if you don't do any communications, you get a very 31, because you have an L1 here. The main gap communications you drop, so it's because it's extra. So I'll show you a few plots of QCD thermodynamics with domain wall fermions. The point is that this is a five-dimensional theory with this very strange way of producing light fermions. And why should it work at all? I mean, it is, actually does work, and it does do thermodynamics, and this is just the standard psi bar psi and Wilson line. You see the transition. This is the thermalization from the two phases. And this is where things have been left. Domain wall fermions has gone through the transition, depending on the cyclic group action, and you see this is the problem. That even for this value of less of 24, you get 400 MeV pions. And you need to go probably to 60 unless you do something else to get physical pions. You can see anomalous symmetry breaking above PC by measuring the susceptibilities, and it's actually there. You can actually see it now because you have such good control of the zero modes. Another thing that was done using domain wall fermions is supersymmetric Young Mills. And this is something that actually is possible to do. N equal 1 as you do super Young Mills. Herbert was one of the first ones to point this out. And the reason is that because domain wall fermions are overlapped at the resort tidal symmetry completely, there is no Gluino master if you go to this limit. The other terms are irrelevant, so they go away. Then you don't need to do fine tuning, and you have a positive Pfaffian, which is a plus in this case. So from a technical point of view, it's very similar to QCD. I know that you have done a lot of work in supersymmetry, and at some point you should be able to touch your because the two methods should agree. And but you have gone so much farther ahead than I have ever. So because this is just, we only measure bulk quantities. We never measure spectrum. But it is interesting now because you can actually count the index. You know it's 2 mu times mc. and you see an operator for SG2, an operator with four Fermi fields is not zero because of the anomaly, so the axial U1 axial breaks down to Z4. But then is the question, what happens to the Z4? And, well, I'm way out of time, so I won't tell you what happens. Okay, so I'll tell you what happens. So, if this is nice paper by Lilloire and Smilga that tells us that this is the relevant number, if this number is much smaller than 1, then the 1 over NC sectors explicitly contribute to this one. So, but for very large volumes and very small mass, these solutions vanish. So it is expected that the Z2 NC will break down to Z2 spontaneously in this case. However, at very small volumes, you don't have spontaneous symmetry breaking, and you still have vents for chi bar chi. It shouldn't have a vent. This, as you increase the length, you get, you know, chiral symmetries restored. It shouldn't have a valve. It's not four Fermi fields, it's just two Fermi fields. But it does. And it has a valve for this tiny little thing. And the reason is that there is fractional topological charge in this series. And people, including Urs, have looked at those with the overlap. But you can see these in the evolution. So this is like the computer is producing a value every step for chi bar chi. And for LS equals 16, it looks like this. But when we go to LS 40, where chiral symmetry is getting restored and zero modes becoming more pronounced, you see these huge spikes popping up. And these are the ones, these are the exact zero modes from a fraction of topological charge that give the verb to psi per psi to the Glinogordon state. I'm sorry?
It's on the relatively coarse slightly.
Yes, it is not the. Yes, it is relatively coarse. So it will get even more dramatic, I think, one to go. Because they are there, that's zero. I mean, they show them also with a
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So in the spirit of last yesterday's talk, I would like to understand this connection very well also. It is possible to do it. It is possible to make the connection. The technology in terms of fermions is there, both for Wilson and for domain Wolf fermions. This connection is possible to do, and we should do it. And now with also the large NC that has been, a lot of work has been done now, this connection has to be made, and probably will be made. And so let me close the talk. I'll show you a movie in a minute, okay? So don't fall asleep. How crazy are you? And to me, one of the things that has always struck as odd is somebody comes up to me and says, well, what good is this for? And especially at IBM. So what would you do? I mean, why are you even looking at these things? Because these people want to see technology. And technology, surprisingly, I think, it's important in terms of science because it's real. But it's real in the sense that you have to think a little like a science fiction guy. Say, well, what if I could manipulate quarks and gluons any way I like? Suppose I could manipulate hadronization. Would I know what to do with it? Could I actually make a quark-gluon plasma and let it hadronize in a state of matter that I like, let's say gold? Can I be an alchemist? What would it take to do this? And I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think any of us knows how to do control hadronization. But it is an interesting question, and it is a technology question. The other thing that I never thought of, and I'm ashamed to say, is that this is from Dan Brown. It's just a novel, right? I don't know if you read it. But he starts the first page with his fact. So this is a fact. Antimatter is the most powerful energy source known to man. It releases energy with 100% efficiency, which is true. And doubling could power New York City for a full day, which is true. And here he misses Fermilab somehow. CERN has now broken ground on its new anti-proton decelerator. So this is the anti-proton storage ring, obviously, but I don't know how many of you have thought of actually antimatter as well, a weapon or a source of energy. Apparently, I think it's 1 gram of mass is about 22 kilotons of energy. So another, I'm sorry?
Is IBM selling
that? You know, IBM is a funny company. They invented the tunneling microscope, right? They never made a penny out of it. So even if they invented a way to destroy the world, they probably won't make a penny out of it. Somebody else could do it for
them. Where's Lyle making a penny?
Probably it's not good for the business, that's right. Another question that I like to ask these days is, you know, there are these people there that do quantum computing. And there are all kinds of people that do quantum computing, ranging from chemists to physicists to mathematicians to software engineers. And everybody has their way of thinking about it. But us physicists now have a new way that we really do think of matter as being calculated. It's nature is calculating matter. And this is not just a fancy way of saying things. The question is, quantum mechanics allows you to do to solve problems of certain complexity that ordinary computers wouldn't. So it allows for this exponential speed up, at least for certain problems. Now, is this particular to the way this computer is built? It exists with photons or electrons. So QED, low energy QED. Now, if it was quarks, if it was high energy stuff, would the computational complexity of the problem you can solve increase? Does it have anything to do with it at all? And finally, a question to ask is, where does QCD break? Because at the place where QCD breaks, it will be something new. And I don't know where QCD breaks. I mean, I don't have any of you know. It's not a correct theory anymore. The same way in classical physics is not correct. Exactly. Classical physics at large.
QCD by itself doesn't commit suicide.
You started with citing Frank Wilczek, and Frank makes a big point of that QCD is probably an internal thing, self-consistent theory.
It is self-consistent. That's why I saw the paper. I start sounding like him. Well,
you know.
Yeah, thank you. No, but
you're asking where the QCD breaks in nature, and this we know. I mean, it breaks at 100 GeV, certainly because there is electricity there. So
maybe I'm not asking this very precisely. What I have in mind, you're right, of course. What I have in mind is classical physics breaks at large speeds and small distances. Now, QCD, in a sense, it is an isolated thing. That, you know, if you take it out as a theory, it connects the dimensional transmutation, it connects the scale, you say. But if you took it out as a theory, is there a parameter? Is there some limit where it's not correct as a theory anymore?
No,
but it's, we don't believe.
I mean, unless you believe it, it would be very exciting if it were.
Yeah, that would be indication.
There is no signal. You know, Tooft was worried at the time that maybe there's no analyticity in G at all. But I think even that worry, the paper is asymptotic freedom enough.
Well, thank you for your input. You're right. And maybe this is a mute question. But on the other hand, one never knows.
There's
right?
Another person who has been recently at the lattice meeting in Fermilab. Ken Wilson is saying maybe we need more gluon fields. So, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
what is the question?
Well, he said that he was not so sure that one set of gluons would be enough to describe the strong interactions.
Phenomenologically.
Yeah. And he speculated that maybe one would need extra flavors of gluons.
No, whether there are for nature, does not the QCD gets bad.
Well, that's of course the question what you define.
What do you mean by, strong interaction, not abelian gates.
No, but if you write a trivial paper, 1/4 F², this thing really defines the abelian theory.
He's not disputing that. It's just for describing the phenomenology of the strong interaction.
I
didn't understand why he wants to do that. I'm, of course, he's interested in this LICOM
picture in connecting the Barton model with QCD. But I don't see why he would need extra flavors of
all of it. Could be a technical.
But see, this
might be technical in the way of achieving a relatively small coupling constant, so you could do this.
I thought, like, I just have to do an accelerator.
He has no prediction. No prediction what scale they might show up.
Let me give you one quick example of what would motivate a question like this, and that's Wheeler's GM. The idea, can you just make gravitational electric, can you generate light intense enough that it will fall in on itself? And I think he started with defiance, it's not stable, but it should in principle be true. These kind of things, you know, you go beyond what is in nature and you just start pushing the thing, you know, just like, okay, you know, energy and matter is the same and gravity is there. I should be able to make, you know.
Well, there's no question that they
so where can you push QCD? At what corner can you push QCD? That's what I was thinking, but maybe I didn't phrase it very well.
I can add a few words on that, because QCD is objective in a sense, thanks to your simple.
Of course.
The coupling to gravity, you can.
See, that's the other point now. See, the other point is, yes, thank you, thank you.
Others here are supposed to fail in
higher. Think about it this way. This is not a trivial thing, because gravity, the way we know it, couples mostly to nuclear matter. And nuclear matter, you look at it, and it's only about 1% of it is matter. So gravity really couples to the internal energy of the proton and neutrons, right? So this kind of things kind of somehow raise these questions, and you should think, I don't say that we should work on this. These are a little bit far-fetched, maybe, for any researcher to be able to justify its existence, but it's still good to have in mind. So this time over, let me finish up. The point is that beyond this very maybe higher kind of like wacky questions, the truth is that QCD, I think, is coming back, and thanks to the Nobel Prize this year, maybe it's the year of QCD. But of course, also the heavy ion collisions at Brookhaven will bring QCD very much to the forefront. LHC has to somehow. Hadronization perhaps will play a role, maybe not. But it does raise question about the physics beyond the standard model. And I know all the objections for Technicolor and all that. But, you know, it's an isolated little world. It may exist at higher energy scales in some way I've not thought of yet.
I don't want to dampen your optimism, but I think the main concern of QCD at the LHC is to get rid of the QCD background.
Correct.
You know, people used to
get that's important, right? It's terribly important. So they may come to here and ask you to do it, right? And of course it's mostly perturbative. I don't know what part is not perturbative. And matrix elements will play a big role there. So I just added this last night, just to tease you. None of us would touch a petaflop anytime soon. But suppose somebody did give you a petaflop tomorrow and told you, have it for a month. What would you do? And I know that all of us have our pet projects, but somehow I tuned in thinking of this pet project with the amount of computing that we have available now. If somebody increased that amount of computing by a factor of 1,000 or 100,000, you'll think of another problem. And what is that problem? And because the petaflop will happen, I can assure you of that, and it will not happen in the very distant future.
How many flops are in a petaflop?
It's a kilo mega giga tera peta, so it's the 15. And then it's the zettaflop, according to Wilson. So let me show you the movie. So this movie was done this summer on half of a refrigerator. And what you're going to see is this is with collaboration with Guillaume Bano, who's also there, Dongchen Alangara, Phil Heidelberger, Jim Sexton, he's at IBM, myself and Bob Volkamp, who wrote a very nice visualization program. So let me show it to you. Go away. Oh, this little statement here. So what you're going to see now is a real simulation with Iwasaki Gates fields, domain Wolf fermions, so as time goes by, I change the temperature. Now, not in a linear way, I really change data. So I do something like 100 steps and then change data. And it starts from the cold phase. This is the phase, the confined phase. And I here the dots represent the value of the Polyakov loop. And the color is how big it is. So red means it's big, blue means it's around zero. So that's somehow. So here it's kind of cold in terms of Polyakov loop. So this is the Polyakov loop at each three-dimensional point of the 16-cube volume. And here you will see the average of all these colors in a real graph as the simulation step increases, and about every 100 I increase the temperature. So here you will go through a phase transition, the thermal phase transition. So this is increasing temperature about every 100. So now the Polyakov line got a big wave in it, and it's in the other phase. So this is how, hopefully, Rick will see things. Maybe the more interesting thing is to see this movie, that you can play this movie actually backwards. And if you play it backwards, of course, you see the fireball of the Big Bang hadronizing. This is not a trivial simulation. This took about 1.5 days on using a half a teraflop sustain, and it is as far as the main Wolf fermions goes, it is the where things are. This is the best you can do.
Thank you. Oh, this is not the 14.
No, this was the real thing. I didn't make it up. Not quench. The full dynamical, the whole thing.
No.
More questions?
Maybe. If you were to do QCD and you would have, the ambition is to get the final mass with, say, 0.5% accuracy, the total mass with 0.5%, ready for electrodynamics.
Sorry?
Total mass, transition amplitude also. How much would you have to increase the computer power factor?
I think that you can go. It's the pioneer mass that really, really kills you. The other hadrons come up very nicely.
No excuses.
QCD. I like that. I think that. Well, depends who you ask. But I think a volume of me. Okay, so 64 cube volume should be large enough. Wilson. Scarce was 128 cube. I think maybe he was a little bit too pessimistic. The 64 cube volume, I think, is good. Now, if you do finite temperature, I think you should keep an aspect ratio of 4 at least. If, probably even larger. So I would say at least 64 cube by 16 for thermodynamics. You could have that. And then you could have an LS of about, at that NT, at NT equals 16, you are fairly weak coupling. So you don't need very large LS, maybe 32.
I want zero temperature.
Zero temperature, you just do 64 to the 4th. And if you do zero temperature, you don't have a constraint. You can probably go, at this point, you can go to weak enough couplings with improvements and improved actions. You can probably get away with an LS of maybe even 12 at that range. This is a guess, of course. But I think if somebody gave you the Livermore machine, you could do no excuses. You should be at zero temperature.
So in answer to this question, so that would be a 4 to the 10th relative to this. So it would be a million more time.
Oh, now you really want to get this. So let's see.
No, you want to do it. So this is
it's a million times. It's a million times more. So let's compare first the size of the machine, okay? So this was in half, one day in half a rack. You get the Livermore machine has 64, So you get a factor of about 100 on that alone.
Okay, so the, from the million you drop to 10,000. 10,000 is still around. But not so bad. No, 10,000
No, it's days. So,
I think the answer,
but
a lot depends on what you aiming for.
That was
so what aspect
no,
you're
no, 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 that's a clear answer.
Right, so if you are targeting
but
very popular,
that's the best calculation. So,
right.
I think that there is a factor of 10 there that can go away because this didn't run at optimal speed when it ran. And DLS of 24 that this has, it's not necessary at this weak couplings.
That's
so
not,
I would,
that's not good. That's
key. But I think it's true. You probably, this is very strong coupling. This is
what
very.
He wants physical quark mass.
And, what I'm trying to say, this sounds about 1,000 days.
1,000 days?
Which
not
is
so
three.
Bad.
So but so they are playing now with factors of two, which is dangerous because I cannot pin them down. And, so it's almost there at the point.
Right. That 1,000 days is not practical. Machine will crash for sure.
Well, you checkpoint. You checkpoint. It doesn't have
several machines.
But the next generation, it won't be 1,000 days anymore.
Your pentacop, explain what we want to do.
If I, that's right. The petaflop will probably reach that point where, of course, he's right. It depends what you want to do.
What I was after is that there's a feeling in the field, which maybe should be transmitted outside, is that in the next decade will be there.
If you ask me personally, and I do not take this lightly at all, I think you're right. I think in the next decade, we will be able to go where we have been trying to go.
I've heard that before.
Come on, Joe. A little optimist. No, but I mean, I'm specific enough. I said physical pion masses, you know, with finite volume effects.
No, I think it's a really important point. I think many people have the feeling that there is a distinct difference between the statement today. And you may have said that also before, and the statement before.
Like said,
the statement before.
Okay, so there is a luggage.
Serious of the statements of today.
You have much more experience with simulations. From which you can make
we know that. But
Joe's right. If we come outside this room and say that, they're going to be like, okay, blah, blah.
Say to the outside.
Yeah. If you say that to the outside, they would say, okay, you guys said that before.
I mean, you should let people
I mean, certain things have been said to the outside that are proposed.
But also, when Joe is right.
Has put out that have presented to
IPAP
and things like that. I mean, we've
one has to be very careful, though. Is what do you measure? He's right. What are you going to measure? I mean, if you claim that you can do decays,
yeah, I mean that's the other thing. The,
then I don't think that's true.
QCD is that.
So I don't think you can do decays. I think you can marginally do decays.
Anytime soon on the computer,
I think
we might be able to compute the spectrum, and we might be able to compute. Some hadronic matrix elements
several.
Interest to experiment with the B factory people and so on with order 1%, I mean with precision that the theory error is not the dominating error.
I think that's what I think I can add some more comments.
No excuse QCD kind of goals.
I think a lot of topics can be closed, basically. So like some of the spectrum issues related to the small quantum mass, those things definitely can be addressed and you can talk about the issues there. However, if you ask how about the scalar mesons, then scalar meson related issue, including all the mixing, is you need order of about 100,000 gauge configuration. Then dynamical simulation with domain or 100,000 configuration with current facility is out of question. So those things still cannot be answered. But how about the ring matrix elements? Okay, there are simple ring matrix elements which can be done, like a K-Calibre mixing kind of thing. which already, we already have a limited theoretical. Current simulation error is a lot smaller than theoretical system error. Even though it improves this much computing facility, we can reduce the error bar of the statistics. However, the systematics still stays there. So not much improvement for that. Then you can ask, how about the hardcore ring matrix elements like epsilon prime, epsilon prime? It will be a significant progress, because the bottleneck is the statistics, computing power. So if it increases...
Well, I think it's also the methods. I mean, there are questions that require improvement in the methods also.
So for some thermodynamic questions, if you ask, putting the chemical potential, how much can you push really hard? There is a methodological problem, but if you choose one of the methods that currently exist, and if you push very hard, still finding the phase strength and get everything right and draw all the phases related to chemical potential is not hypothesis.
But that's really this is the sign problem case, and that's a different story.
Right, and so a lot depends on what you ask, specific question.
Yeah, depends on what.
Right.
That's all I want to see.
Even experiment is
no. I know. That's why we still have a chance.
Okay.